Not so little many, rather large many, very big many. You see, they won't be able to do that, so long as their number system is 1, 2, 3, many. So then it can never be a fact for such a person that a room has 4 corners. It has many corners, or else 3. But once you've got the idea of 4, then you can see that it has 4 corners. When I see the sun rising, I know that the sun isn't moving, but the earth is turning. One has traveled enough in aeroplanes to see that for oneself. And the question then now is this. If someone believes that the sun is rising and the earth is still, when he looks at the sunrise, is he seeing the same thing I'm seeing? I don't think he is. Because my seeing has an entirely different interpretation on it than his seeing. So, what you understand also determines what you see. So, that's what's meant by a jnana yoga in India, a method of awakening through intellectual mind, through intellectual understanding. People say you can't get it intellectually. That's partly true, but only partly true. That means, first of all, well, for example, the old Hindu saying that you cannot get wisdom through books is, as I explained, because it's a dialogue. But also it's because the books that exist are only notes. In other words, all the sacred books are nothing more than memoranda, just like the notation of Hindu music is only a memorandum. It's not something you follow. It's a reminder of a certain raga or theme, and then you play it and improvise on it. So in the same way, all the aphorisms in the Yoga Sutra or the verses of the Gita and so on, they're notes, little jottings, and then the teacher will explain them. So when something is understood very thoroughly by the thinking mind, it will eventually become a sensation because you'll really understand it, you see? So that I'm saying all this as a basis for seeing that when Buddhism envisages the character and the consciousness of the highest form of man, which it calls Bodhisattva, it is not somebody who's out of this world. It's not somebody who's in a state of some weird ecstasy, or somebody who sees everything kind of full of angels, as we might expect in the ordinary way, or anything like that. Real angels, gods, and so on, are very different from what you might suppose in the imagery. You can find out, for example, that the dust is full of gods. If you really look at dust, and that the pores of your skin contain many universes. And that's marvelous, you see. That's to see that things are full of gods, but you're still not seeing anything different from the ordinary things you see, but you've got a different understanding of it. So, having a different understanding, you're nevertheless the same world, same everyday life, same everything going on that everybody else has. The understanding, in other words, is not away from this everyday kind of experience we're having now. So there's the Bodhisattva. And this is an extraordinarily important vision for the whole of Asia. Why? Because there was always a tendency in Asian spirituality to want to go away. That's very understandable, because when life is rough, And there are terrible plagues and wars and hunger and diseases. A lot of people would think, oh, enough is enough is enough. And if this is going to go on and on, if we're going to be reincarnated back and back into this mess, isn't there some way of getting out? So in that way, you can lose all interest in everyday life. For example, supposing you are a drunk, a really serious, dedicated drunk, and lots of people are. They want out. And they couldn't care less whether they have no money, whether they're going to die, whether they're dead, just so long as they can stay out. Now, you might say, as we look at people like that, well, that's very sad. It's terrible. Look at they're wasting their lives. But from their point of view, they're not. They're living the real out life they want to live. Or a person may be an opium addict, you see, and he'll be in his special paradise. And you say, well, isn't that terrible? Well, he wants out. And from his point of view, as he looks at it, it's perfectly all right because he thinks the people who are pursuing those ends which are considered virtuous and practical, he thinks they're out of their minds. Why do all that? Why do you have to go on struggling and struggling and struggling to keep alive? What do you think that's going to give you? You see? So he feels it doesn't matter if it ends sooner or if it ends later. Time is an illusion. In his state of consciousness, he can make a tiny little bit of time into a long, long time. He can experience 100 years in an afternoon, or longer. And some people think, you see, that you might have immortality through the fact that in the moment of your death, your sense of time gets longer and longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. So that although from the standpoint of an outside observer who is not in your state of consciousness, it looks as if you are having your head cut off in a hurry, from your standpoint, that lasts forever because of the alteration of your time rhythm. See how slippery philosophy can be. And so people can think all these things and they can get lost. And there was always a tendency in Oriental culture to do that. And from our point of view, that's a bad thing. Well, from, say, the Chinese point of view, also, it was a bad thing. The Chinese were very practical. And they believed in the family and in having children and husbands and wives and in industriousness and in building and in arts and in cultivating the soil by very ingenious methods. And so there was a special appeal to them in the idea of the bodhisattva. Bodhisattva, you see, he's not like the extremely contemplative private Buddha. You won't find a bodhisattva sitting all day under a tree in a state of rapt absorption, so that anybody who comes up and knocks on him won't get an answer. He'll be like everybody else. Or he will look like everybody else, because he will see that this everyday world too is it. This no special, nothing special world. Misty rain on Mount Lu, waves surging at Jijang. When you have not been there, no rest from the pain of longing. But you go there and come back. It was nothing special. Misty rain on Mount Lu, surging waves at Jijang. this isn't meant, you see, to debunk it and say, well, after all, you know, sort of it was a nasty baby anyhow, it only died to spiders. It isn't a kind of thing, oh, it was nothing, like that. In the idea of nothing special, or buji, there is a way of saying but look at ordinariness. Look what you miss every moment. And you see that sort of attitude underlies tea ceremony, where a very great appreciation exists of the very simplest kinds of utensils, rooms, architecture, and so on. There was a very great sage who lived far off in the mountains behind Kyoto, and an American student had great desire to see him, and he made all sorts of inquiries to find this man. At last found the way to the hermitage, but then it was very difficult to get there. But he did finally find the old man out and came and said, "How do you do?" And they talked. And the old man was delighted that the foreign student should have taken all that trouble and should show such good understanding of these things that he served him tea ceremony with nothing but hot water. No tea, see. And the American student was delighted. He realized that this man had paid him a real compliment. So, that's bougie, you see, that's nothing special. Now then, generally speaking, as we look at the whole field of Buddhism, the idea of the bodhisattva, that is to say, the idea of realizing the enlightened state in terms of everyday life, is characteristic of the Mahayana school of the North, North Asia. Whereas the Theravada or sometimes Hinayana school of South Asia still has its emphasis on the idea of getting away. Still very much concentrates on the ideal of the monkish life, which is celibate and away from all everydayness, all attachment, all kinds of worldly responsibility. And so those monks in their yellow robes are very much a people apart. In the Mahayana, on the other hand, although there are monks, they aren't monks quite in the sense of the Southern school. I mean, it's like a Roman Catholic priest is not supposed to marry, but an Episcopalian priest may. So in that sense, the Southern monks are like Roman Catholic monks, and the Northern monks are like Anglican clergy, something like that, except that they have a rule that if they do live in a monastery, they mayn't take wives in there. And likewise, the nuns mayn't have husbands in there. But if they live apart in a temple, a priest may have a wife, because they see no fundamental inconsistency between the state of deeply illuminated consciousness and living in some kind of affectionate human community and society. So, therefore, for that reason, through Mahayana, through the idea of the Bodhisattva, Buddhism was able to exercise an enormous influence upon the everyday life of the Far East, to express itself through art forms that were by no means stereotyped, not merely iconographic and stylized. Buddhism in the Far East expressed itself through naturalistic art forms. And so, it's an extraordinary thing, but you see, the religious painting of China, insofar as it is influenced by Zen Buddhism, very rarely has a religious subject. When you would say, what is Christian art? Well, you would recognize that certain great schools and styles, you would say, you would associate Romanesque architecture with Christianity, certainly Gothic architecture. You would associate early Italian painting or a great deal of Russian painting with Christianity, peculiarly. But Christian art, you see, always seems to have for its subject matter the Christ, the saints, the angels, the incidents in the lives of the saints, their martyrdoms, and so on and so forth. But it's inconceivable to get the idea, is it, that a still life, which might have been painted by a Christian, is a form of Christian art, when all that's in it is a few apples on the table. That a case could be made for that idea, but it hasn't been made. It's never really occurred to someone to express Christianity through that sort of method. Oh, it's true that there has been a symbolism. The grapes and the wheat represent the sacrament, the Mass. That lilies represent something, and so on and so forth. But this is purely symbolic. It wouldn't occur for Christian art that the fine painting of a used ashtray with a piece of torn paper beside it could possibly be Christian art, unless it was propaganda against being dirty or something like that. See? But for the Far East, a painting of an old rock with some grass growing beside it can most definitely be Buddhist art, because that painting of the rock is concerned with suchness. And just as much so as any painting of Buddhas in their halos and golden jewelries and flowers and lotuses and all that kind of thing. So likewise, when this school of painting paints Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it makes them look like ordinary people. Even a little bit, to get the point over, a little bit more than ordinary. That is to say, tramps, bums, clowns, this fellow. This is Hote, or Putai in Chinese, and he is a fat slob. But he goes around with an enormous bag, patched and so on, and he collects trash. He collects everything that nobody wants. See, ordinary people are always out for precious things, but Putai is out for rubbish. And he collects all this rubbish and he gives it away to children, who love it. See? Well, this is a way, you see, this is true. This man is sometimes called the fat or laughing Buddha. And he is a fat Buddha. But the only clue that he is a Buddha is his big ears, because that means he can hear right through everything. See? He can hear the ultimate sound in everybody's voice. Now, that's a very important trick. If you listen to me talking, you may try to make sense of the words. But actually, in the sense of the words that I'm saying, isn't the content of what I'm trying to explain. The content of what I'm trying to explain can be heard in the sound of my voice. And in order to listen to that properly, you have to go beyond its meaning. For example, if you say the word yes, and then say it again, yes, 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 it becomes a very funny word. And you think, why did we use that funny noise, yes, to mean yes? Or you might see somebody sitting like this, you know. Say, imagine this is on a movie. And the man just sitting there for a while, and then suddenly he goes, he shrugs his shoulders. That's a normal enough gesture. It might mean he was just puzzled. But as he's going on sitting there, he does, and you wonder, hey, what's the matter? It's got a tick. Suddenly you see the gesture begins to lose meaning. It becomes somebody being... Well, that's you have to have big ears to get that, you see. So it's through that that you know he hears all sounds as being just sounds. Of course, he can hear meaning in them too when they have meaning.